Dune. Let's do Dune.
All right, let's do Dune. Let's do Dune.
Let's do that Dune.
Yes, let's do that Dune. Let's do that Dune that you Dune so well, Denny. There you go. Welcome back to the Visually Stunning Movie Podcast. I'm Mark. That's Ryan at the other end of the mic. How you doing this morning, Ryan?
Well, good, I think. We'll see.
You guys don't know that Ryan's gonna nap, and I had to text him to wake him up. Let's do that Dune.
Yeah.
Let's talk Dune Part 2. Now, we had slightly differing opinions on Dune Part 1 in that I was upset that I didn't know going in that it was half a movie.
Which is fair.
Yeah. So my end result was that I didn't dislike what we saw in Dune Part 1. I was upset that it was not a complete product. And that he needed to land Part 2 to make this work.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get the technical crap out of the way. Dune Part 2 picks up right after the end of Dune Part 1. It is 2 hours and 46 minutes. Again, we are in an epic length film. There's not a problem with it. Okay, so look, so yeah, Oppenheimer, I didn't begrudge the 3 hours. Killers of Flower Moon, I totally begrudged the 3 hours. Right out the gate, I don't begrudge Denis Villeneuve.
Nope.
The 2 hours and 46 minutes. I think he showed terrible restraint in this to keep it under 3 hours. So let's talk about it for a minute, because there's a lot of stuff going around. It's not out yet. It comes out next week. We saw it. Our screening was at Dolby Atmos, so we got all of the sound. There's a screening again Monday in IMAX, which I'm going to go see. So I don't know if you are as well, but I'm interested to see it just as big as humanly possible.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how things sort.
But so, like I said, so this movie picks up literally right at the end of Part 1. But it's weird because Villeneuve chooses the start of this film to introduce us to Princess Irulan, played by Florence Pugh, who does a voiceover to narrate the interregnum between films, which is really all of about 30 seconds, but catches you up on everything and where we are now. I thought that was an interesting choice. And it kind of harkens back to the narrative duties from Lynch's version back in the day for her. And then we jump right in. Once again, I may have said this in Part 1. People dog Lynch's version of Dune. But I have long said that as written, Dune is actually unfilmable. Therefore, you have to find a way in. Lynch took a way in and made a movie, and I still enjoy Lynch's version. Denis Villeneuve picks his way in and has given us now two parts of a movie. And you'll note the ellipsis at the end of that statement. But he's chosen his way in. So this, again, Dune is a political treatise. If you bother to read it, that book is just politics from beginning to end. And that's a really boring movie. It's a great book, but it's a really boring movie. So I think what's cool is that, anytime there's a political debate, Denny always manages to frame it in it turns into a military battle. The political battles turn into military battles that are representative of the political battles, which cinematically are better to try to show an audience. Sure. But even the religious stuff often turns into physical conflict in his film, which also is more It's more fun to watch people talking about religion than it is politics, but neither one is really cinematic. So I think it's interesting that everything they'll start a political debate and it rolls right into a physical conflict. And they'll start religious and it rolls into a physical conflict. And this one is, I think this is more a religious movie than it is a political one. Whereas the first film was a very political film as opposed to a religious one. Agree or disagree?
I think that's fair. I think, yeah, I mean, this is dealing with the rise of an individual who may or may not be the subject of a prophecy. Some choose to believe, some choose not to believe, some choose to be confused and kind of in the middle and not quite sure. No, I think that's fairly accurate. Yeah, I think it has shifted. The story does shift to more of a religious, lead us out of Egypt sort of thing.
Yeah, which, of course, there's going to be a lot of stuff, which we'll get to in that, because there's a couple points that I wanted to make about some of the presentation in here. Look, so we get the whole cast back, the ones that aren't dead. Timothée Chalamet is Paul Atreides, Zendaya is Chani, Rebecca Ferguson is his mother Jessica, Javier Bardem is still awesome as Stilgar, Josh Brolin returns eventually as Gurney Halleck, but then again we get this expanded cast where Florence Pugh comes in a supporting role. Christopher Walken is the Emperor Shaddam the Fourth, I believe. Mm-hmm. Austin Butler steps into Sting's skinny jeans and is Fade Rotha. Leah Seydoux shows up for two scenes as a Bene Gesserit of some import that may or may not fall into the ellipses that I had in my thing. You know, Charlotte Rampling is still here as the Reverend Mother. Stellan Skarsgård is still Baron Harkonnen. So he expands this cast. And they're all really good additions from an acting standpoint. And then the way he integrates their characters and develops them is really interesting. I'm still marginally disappointed I don't get more Christopher Walken, because he doesn't want more Christopher Walken, but I think we got just the right amount in this. Austin Butler is frightening here. Yeah. Absolutely. All of that like manic psycho energy that Sting had in the Lynch version feels a lot more subdued, but just as intense.
Yeah, I would say it's less camp, but you know, I mean, and that's not a knock necessarily on the, you know, Lynch's Dune. I think is interesting too is Lynch's Dune obviously had a major influence on this film. And the one that, you know, I guess, you know, there's this sort of notion that Lynch's film was so bad that no one wants to recognize that it existed. But that's not really the case at all. I think it's become, you almost have to do some of the things that Lynch did or people are going to feel like, well, that's not how that's supposed to be. And I think you feel sort of that's elements of that, you know, in those narrations and things in this film. I'm sure there is a 4-hour cut of this material
of part two.
Somewhere at least a 4-hour cut.
Oh yeah, the first cut.
So yeah, so I'm sure there's a lot. There is a lot of stuff probably that got whittled away, but you know, there's not a lot of that on this film, and that I think makes the length, you know, justifiable. There's no point in where you're like, oh, okay, this is just going on. If you could have cut this down, this would, you know, there's no real point where that happens. Now, are there scenes where that could happen? Probably, but.
But they're few and far between.
Work. Yeah, if they actually are there and you never feel that way. You know, I guess if I watch the film with the idea of, okay, we've got to shave 15 minutes, I may look at it differently, but. You know, just going in and seeing what it is and getting dropped into a lot of things. There's not a lot of explanation for who some of these people are. It's almost just, it's assumed that the audience is smart enough to figure out who they are, or to at least grasp the general concept of what is happening.
Right.
And I like movies that are that, that don't feel like they need to, okay, let's just stop and take 10 minutes to explain. For all of you, you know, if they can do it in 30 seconds, they do it in 30 seconds. And I think that's great.
Yep. We just talked about how there's not a lot of fat here. There's not a lot of lingering. And one of the observations I made is that, between the first film and this film, he builds this world, right? And it's impressive to see these vast desert scapes and all of this beautiful cinematography that is this world. And in talking about the length, the observation I made is that at no point this is the dry land version of Avatar and its underwater world. But whereas James Cameron incessantly just had 5-minute sequences of just Avatar tourism shots, to show off what he's done, Villeneuve does not do that. And I think that's the difference. Cause he could make an Arrakis travelogue video. That's just nothing but scenery and the little, the desert, the kangaroo mouse and, you know, all of that stuff. And he could have made 5-minute sequences of that to just show off the world. And he didn't. And I appreciated that. And again, that helps make the overall runtime more palatable than it might otherwise have been.
Yeah. You know, you could probably, if you went in, you could edit together that travelogue video. That's how it should be done. It's integrated in a way that you would have to literally go back and pull a clip here, clip where, you know, whereas with the Avatar stuff, it's just right there.
Yeah.
You know, it's in your face. It's thrown at you. You know, and obviously with Dune, the planet, it's pretty important. It's a character in the film.
Oh God, yes.
In the story.
And it always has been.
And so, yeah. And so I think the way that he integrates it in there as if the planet occasionally gets their say, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they, as much as any other character in this ensemble, it speaks when it needs to speak. And so I think you can't make a movie without, or this movie without having the planet play a major role in it. And I think, but it is finding that balance and, you know, is he showing off and, you know, he's not, he makes beautiful, gorgeous movies, but you never really feel like there's a pointlessness to all of it.
Yeah.
It seems to be beautiful with a reason. And that's, you know, again, a film like this, you know, this version has, it's hard for me. It feels like this has a little more action, maybe. And maybe it is because they're not as political. But that said, the first one had quite a bit of action as well. So,
it did.
I don't know. But what I think is really nice about this film and the first film is it doesn't feel like it's ripping anything off. It doesn't feel like if you were to see a scene from this, you wouldn't go, that could be Star Wars or, you know, that it, you know what I mean? But it has its own feel. It doesn't, it's, you know, and part of that's because of the material it's based on. But even, I don't know, there's just something special about this world that makes it different from other sand planets that we see in other sci-fi films and the like, and the tone of this, and even the tone of the Lynch film is different than what you get from space opera.
Yeah.
This is, you know, I don't know. It's just something that it should feel like other films, but it doesn't. And I think that's part of the reason why it's so engrossing for me.
Hey everyone. Welcome back to season 9. Of the Visually Stunning Movie Podcast. If you like what you're seeing and hearing, please feel free to like us, share us, follow us wherever you're listening to us, actually. If you're on YouTube, click subscribe. That would be great. Go to the website at vsmoviepodcast.com, and that will give you links to all of our socials. It'll give you write-ups of stuff that's not audio, but you'll get pretty much everything there. So If you like what you're seeing and hearing, make sure you share it with everyone else. Now let's get back to the show.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Yeah, and that's why this, you know, the original novel, I mean, and there are countless novels set in the Duneverse at this point. But that original novel, I mean, that's why people had been trying to make a film of it forever. Yeah. because it's pre Star Wars, you know, it's post 2001, I believe it's post 2001, but it's got all of these, it is a unique property in that it's a science fiction movie that doesn't take place in outer space. Also has, you know, realistic politics, a realistic look at religion. It's a really complete universe that Frank Herbert built that people have sent, you know, him and his son and some other writers have, you know, consequently expanded on. But it is, it, that does make it an attractive target, and you don't want to remove what made it attractive to you as a filmmaker in the first place to make the movie. And again, that's hard given this. I mean, the source material's compelling, but not always cinematic. So, you know, there is a balancing act, but so you have to do some things, but you can't take too much or you lose why you liked it in the first place. And then you wind up with some generic movie, Rebel Moon. So, in this film, you know, Paul Atreides, tries to integrate himself into the Fremen society, and work his way up as a warrior rather than be killed. His mother, is, you know, her choices are death or become their Reverend Mother. And Chani's job is to not to fall in love with Paul, while keeping him alive.
And to ground him
in so many ways. But you know, at every turn, people are trying. So his mother. Let me back up. The Bene Gesserit sisterhood, for 1,000 years, they've been manipulating things, you know, been mixing bloodlines, eliminating bloodlines, doing this, doing the other thing. His own mother conceived him against the wishes of the order as a son, but is now almost actively working against his desires, Paul's desires, to not be seen as the savior, as the answer to Fremen prophecy, a prophecy that was written by the Bene Gesserits. So, I jotted down on my notes, as you know, the hubris or the machinations of the Bene Gesserits they're boundless. It's amazing. Yeah. And so he's actively working against his mother, who is actively trying to advance him, but not for his sake, but for the order's sake. But the
order would say not for this.
No, for the empire's stake or the universe's stake. Yeah. So it's a nice mix of politics and religion while he's fighting a war for the practical purpose of trying to liberate the planet for the Fremen. So there's all of these things that are coming through. And look, let me get this out of the way, because I've said it 100 times. I am not a huge Timothy Chalamet fan. Haven't been.
Yeah.
I don't get it. And he spent most of the first movie just speaking in hushed tones, and not really showing me anything. And he spends most of this movie doing the exact same thing, except at the point where he kind of, he doesn't accept his role as savior necessarily in that way, but he exploits it in a moment. And in that speech, in that moment, he has shown me more as an actor than he showed me anywhere else in anything that I've seen him in. And so I was like, oh, finally, Timothée Chalamet is acting for me. So I was really happy with that bit. This thing is plotted so well. Every twist, and yeah, there's not a lot of fat because almost everything is relevant. Almost every line of dialogue is relevant. Almost every battle is relevant in some way, four steps down the line, until it comes to a head where he gives this speech where he basically says, fuck all y'all, this is how it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful sequence. I love it. I just wish I saw more of that. And we might.
Yes.
Moving forward, because we are going to get a part three, and that will be Dune Messiah, because he's now he's embracing his role as Messiah by the end of the film at this point. Because it's almost like I thought there was a wonderful bit from Zendaya when she's screaming at people. They're talking about the prophecy. She goes, "The prophecy is what keeps us prisoner."
Yeah,
because you're always waiting. You're waiting. This can't be the answer to the prophecy. No, this is a false prophet. You have to wait. You have to wait. You have to wait. So you're never free of that prophecy.
Well, it makes you inactive.
Yes,
because you're waiting for someone to save you rather than taking something and as a group of people who have been turned into outcasts.
Yes,
But it is noted that they are a large enough group of people that if they were to uprise, or if there's an uprising, that they would be formidable. But they're waiting for the prophet.
Yep.
It's good because it's true for one thing.
Right.
And I love the way that. This Paul really embraced the idea of, I don't know. Paul's such a question mark, I think, in this film and towards the end. And what is he really? I mean, is he just seizing the moment? Is he starting to believe? Or, and I like the fact that remains somewhat undefined. And the people around him react differently to the way he evolves. And it's not always for the better. And in fact, in a lot of cases, it's an eye roll and I can't believe you're doing this sort of thing. And, again, this comes into, do you believe the religious, text, or do you think it's baloney, or, where do you fall on that? And then that partially informs why the people react the way they do. It's just intelligent stuff.
Yeah, go ahead. Real quick, though, you're right. This is really intelligent stuff. This is heady stuff that's going to make you think maybe about things you don't necessarily want to think about or you hadn't considered before. But I had to laugh to myself when we had the Life of Brian moment. I was just like, I can't believe they just ripped up the Life of Brian. Which I love Monty Python, so it jumped right out at me. But, only the true Messiah will deny his divinity. And I just like that speaks to religious zealotry. That speaks to, political manipulation. That speaks to, that speaks to so much. It's so true. And it came out of a Monty Python film.
Yeah, well, and again, the reason why that works so well in the Monty Python film and it works here is it's kind of true, because it's that false humbleness, that sort of, because at some point, if you're going to be a savior, you kind of have to embrace the role to a certain extent.
Yep.
I mean, you have to believe that, you are capable.
You are the one, Neo.
Yes. And so it's that exactly. I mean, that's why that particularly the first Matrix film works so well, is because that's kind of what it's exploring that whole idea. I mean, this is, you know, it's even, you see it to an certain extent in Star Wars. You see, I mean, all sorts of, but the fact that you see it in this and it doesn't feel like, oh, we've seen this before, I think is what makes this just so interesting to me. And you do question your relationship with Paul. As an audience member, well, what do I think? You know, how is his behavior? You know, what is driving his behavior? And as an audience member, you're not quite, it's not really told to you. You kind of have to build up your own idea about it. And I love that.
Yeah. I mean, because it's not just, you know, the Fremen saved him and his mother, you know, and he wants revenge on the Harkonnens. It's not just he loves Chani and wants to, you know, try to make her life better. Let's not, and of course, then it's not all just, you know, people are pushing him to say that he's the savior. Let's not forget how much guilt he has for the fact that his father was trying to do the same thing from a different angle of attack before he was killed, which was harness desert power and free Arrakis. You know, he might not have made it free. I think eventually he would have gotten there, Duke Leto, but he kind of had the same thing. And now, you know, Paul has inherited that on top of everything else of trying to stay alive, both socially and literally, you know, and keep his mom alive. And we haven't even discussed how Villeneuve has addressed the big question everyone had, which was his sister, Arya.
Yeah.
Which I think is a cool thing that he did, the way he handles it. And so I don't want to speak any more to that. But I think the way he uses that character and integrates that character is, I think it's interesting, and it still fits with the mythology that we've got and we know from before. But it's not the same, which is nice.
No, it's just, I think some people may take issue with that element of the film because it does differ from what we've seen before. It does differ from what I remember from the text. But does it work? And I would say it absolutely works. And maybe, you know, again, you think the Lynch film and that character had a significant screen presence in that film, and they've changed it quite a bit for this one. But again, with your whole ellipses thing, for this one that's what's kind of compelling about this is, you know, at this point, they could end the film where it ends. If you're unfamiliar with the story, you probably see it as pretty solid place to end. But if you know the story, you also go, oh, did it again.
Yep.
And in my case, I was like, and I'm okay with that. I think, you know, well, I mean, it's like, you know, it's like the extended versions of The Lord of the Rings. Those are my preferred go-to versions because it has more stuff in there and all of it is pretty important. And yes, I could watch the shorter version and get essentially the same story.
Right.
But sometimes it's those little details and those little things, the artistry of the director, the choices that they make of how they present certain aspects and that makes something interesting. Cause this is an interpretation, And to a degree, it can only be a unique interpretation. You feel like no one else would have necessarily made the film this way, and I like that, and I actually like that about the David Lynch film. For as uneven or you know, there's things that you could say about the Lynch film, but also you got to remember the era that it was made, that they weren't really into doing three-part movies based on, you know, I mean, it just...
And if a movie was 2 hours, it was almost too long.
And so, I mean, because they wanted to be able to show it so many times during the day, yeah. There's a lot, lots of things. They kind of moved away from, you know, we had the golden age of cinema where movies were as long as they needed to be, and some of them were even longer, but we had kind of reacted against that. Anyway, this is a film that feels like it was allowed to be whatever it needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that trust that was given is paid off.
Yeah. I mean, you have to, studios need to, we've talked about this. They need to trust if you're going to hire a creative and not, you know, not a director, chair, manager. If you're going to hire a creative, you have to trust them to a point, Zack Snyder. You do need to, don't just turn them loose to go and do it. I mean, especially with the budgets like this would have had. I mean, you can't.
Well,
you can't do that.
On the Zack Snyder side of things, I think the problem there is they gave the wrong creator complete control, because some directors are really good at certain things and some directors are good at a lot of things. I think Zack Snyder's good at a few things, but not necessarily everything. And with Dune, we've got, you know, an artistic vision that melds with the script, I mean, everything complements each other. Yeah. Nothing is more important than the other aspect of it. It's all incredibly important, and it's all handled with the same sort of respect. And this includes the score, because there are moments where it's like, oh, there isn't much score here. And then there are moments where, oh, there's a lot of score here.
You know, I don't know that I'm necessarily a fan of all of the throat singing. That audio, it becomes grating after a time, but you know, it's part of that world and I just have to live with it.
Yeah. I mean, and I can see how that would be grating, but I also think that it is such an established element of the world and of people of that world that even if it's grating, because heaven knows there's chanting and things that other cultures do that, you know, if you were to remove them from that cultural location or whatnot, that wouldn't really work nearly as well. But as part of the big picture, I think it works. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I just, again, there might be people who say, well, you've got all these great actors in there, and shouldn't we be spending more time with some of them? And my response to that would be, well, the story dictates that.
Yeah.
You know, the story dictates how much we see a character. And I think the story, in this sense, in this film, dictates exactly how often we should see these people. And do you want to see them more? Sure. Yeah, absolutely. There's things that you're like, oh, well, I wonder what so-and-so is doing during this period. But whatever they're doing isn't as important as what you're actually seeing. Right. So there are choices that are made. I don't know. It's just, I love the thoughtfulness of this film. And I don't know how else to, you know, I can give it the highest praise for that. I mean, I don't know if this is the greatest sci-fi film ever made. In fact, I would bristle against trying to determine that in the moment.
Yeah, the phrase cinematic masterpiece keeps getting thrown around, and I'm like, stop, just stop. It's a really good film. Yeah. Go and enjoy it. Worry about the superlatives later.
Yeah. Yeah, in 10 years from now, in 20 years from now, let us look at that.
Right.
You know, let us assess that further down the line rather than, you know, it becomes, you know, poster quotes. And which almost makes it seem less sincere.
Yeah.
So let's just wait. Let's wait on, you know, and also let's wait for the whole story. Again, you know, it's... it's you know, in the case of Lord of the Rings, it didn't win all its Oscars until the story was completed. And I think that there is logic in that. Do I think the third part of Lord of the Rings was the strongest? No. But it's where they finished the story.
Yep.
You know, it's so we that it's when everything came together. And I'm really taken in by Dune, part one and two at this point.
Yeah. We don't talk politics, so I'm not going to bring up something that I have in my notes. I'll put it in my written review. But let me, as an aside, we've been talking about movies recently, and I keep saying February has been the dumping ground for movies.
Yeah.
It is February when we're talking about this. However, I would like to point out that it does slide under the rail and release on March 1st.
Yeah,
so that literally, the Dune Part 2 marks the beginning of the serious cinematic year. I think that's the way I'll put it. Everything before now, award season starts now, if you will. For whatever award you're thinking about this one, you know, this is when the movies are going to start releasing that we're going to be talking about. We're not going to be talking about all of them. Because some of them are going to be garbage, but from this point on, this is where we're going to start having movies that we're going to be talking about in 7, 8, 9 months, and that's I'm excited. This is a great way to kick it off. If we get more movies that are half as good as this year, it should be a pretty good year. I can't guesstimate what people are going to watch. But it should be a pretty good year at the theaters if we get more movies that are even half as good as this. So I'm excited moving forward.
Yeah, it's nice to. I mean, I think we all expected it to be in this area of quality. So it's nice to have it actually be.
Yeah.
To at least live up to, the general idea that we had of it.
Yeah. I mean, my superlative, if I had, a gun to my head right now, I'm going to find it's magnificent.
Yeah.
I'm not going to throw out, it's not cinematic, man. It's not the best science fiction film of the last decade or whatever, ridiculous stuff people are throwing out there right now.
But, and the thing about that is it may be, but give us time to figure that out.
Right. It's, otherwise, you're in a situation where Rachel Zegler wins Action Star of the Year. So, which is just weird.
Yeah.
But, it is very good, and I'm sure there are superlatives you can apply to it. Let's not have a coronation yet.
No.
On anything. It's a little early. Slow your roll, kids. But yes, Dune Part 2. Friday, March 1st. I'm probably going to go ahead and recommend it. If you can see it in IMAX, see it in IMAX. I anticipate the viewing experience in IMAX to be better. But sound actually is really important. So make sure you get a good sound in your theater, whichever one you pick. So, there you go. That is Dune Part 2. We've got more stuff to talk about. We've got more stuff coming to watch, which we will. But until we do, don't forget to like us, follow us on social media at VS Movie Podcast. You know how all that garbage works. So until we talk to you again, I'm Mark. That is Ryan. Bye, Ryan.
See you, friends.
And we will talk to you all later.